Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 21st of March, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in studio, Mike Robinson. Well, we're delighted to say we are joined today by Mark Anderson from American Free Press and also Truth and Blogspot. Mark will be reporting on matters American. Before we get there, we better say a few words of sympathy, really, for those north of the border, because we understand that quite a few areas of Scotland have had some pretty cold conditions and snow. So that's what happens if you live north of the border. We'll also say that today is no longer happy because, of course, World Happiness Day was yesterday. But we do understand today is World Down Syndrome's Day. And we would just like to say that it's interesting when we look across the wealth of charities and non-governmental organisations and indeed some government organisations that say they're there to protect Down syndrome children. We still don't see any of them, any single one of them coming out to speak about Holly Gregg. And we certainly have not forgotten about the Holly Gregg case and the abuse that that young lady suffered. Of course, the British government has remained silent.
Indeed. OK, Mark, let's get straight into it then. With the passing of David Rockefeller, dead at 101. I understand that your coverage of this in American Free Press differs slightly from the obituary in the New York Times.
Yes, it does. And it even differs quite a bit from what I would call the obituary in InfoWars. Alex Jones' website reported this much in the way the New York Times would, with the possible exception, the clear exception, actually, of the one quote from Rockefeller's book, Memoirs, a 2002 book, where he openly said he's proud that he's led the world government charge and he stands guilty of doing that against the consent of the governed. He openly admitted that in 2002 in that book, Memoirs. Yes, this came up. Of course, I wasn't surprised. He was born in 1915. I remember at the Bilderberg meeting in 2011 in St. Moritz, Switzerland, there was people that came down the hill like carrying torches. It looked like something out of an old Frankenstein movie. And he was at Hotel Savretta House with Bilderberg at that 2011 Swiss meeting. And the people came down the hill with the torches and they were singing Happy Birthday, David Rockefeller, in the loudest possible voice, and they even brought him a cake in a very, you know, sarcastic kind of way. And the Swiss police apparently delivered the cake to David Rockefeller that day. It was all very funny in a sort of ironic sense, in a derisive sense in many ways. But yeah, here we have the passing of this titan, this grandson of the Standard Oil founder, John D. Rockefeller. And it's very significant in that this guy laid such a heavy groundwork for making big business into an ally of world government and to make big business and government basically one and the same. Rockefeller helped mold the two things together, literally weld them together, big business and government, to help get a situation where government would no longer represent the general population anymore, but would in fact go hand in hand with big business. Few people have done more to make that happen than David Rockefeller. Of course, his father, John D. Jr., and his grandfather, the Standard Oil founder, John D. Rockefeller Sr., laid the groundwork for that as well. But it's very interesting to note that, as I wrote in this article, that he was very instrumental in solidifying the Bilderberg meetings. He didn't help found them, but he did get involved as he became president of the Council on Foreign Relations for around 15 years. That's a big Bilderberg-connected think tank, as you guys know, as is the Trilateral Commission. Those things were given very short shrift in the New York Times, which only mentioned those organizations in passing as if they had no more significance than a art committee somewhere or something like that. And that was a big thing. You guys mentioned philanthropy, and you talk about false charities a lot on your show. Well, the Rockefellers, including David especially, through his ownership of the Museum of Modern Art, or MoMA, helped put on this false philanthropic front, this charitable front, to make everything smell like roses that the Rockefellers and other Mattoid interests engaged in. But while some of it was real and some of it might be laudable, it was largely a front to cover up the more nefarious operations where the CFR and the Trilats and the Bilderbergs have built this world government imperium that's just about coming to fruition, although it's weakening a little bit. And so this is not just another obituary like the New York Times put in its paper, although of course it ran a very long and glowing obituary. This is the passing of one of the chief architects of the system that's trying to swallow normal culture up in this world consolidation imperium. And so much could be said about Mr. Rockefeller, but in this article that I posted at AmericanFreePress.net, and people can read more about it there, again, that's AmericanFreePress.net, we have to keep his main quote in mind, where he wrote in his book, "Some even believe we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists and conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure, one world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty and I am proud of it," end quote. David Rockefeller's exact words. So he himself cleared up any doubts about his main goals and his main activities, but the New York Times in his hometown didn't outline any of that. And are you guys going to get into the Comey and Mike Rogers testimony to Congress today about the Trump alleged surveillance and the alleged collusion with Russia? Is that part of today?
Well, in brief, yes, because we do have a lot to get through, Mark.
Yes. When you get to that, I'll bring up another aspect of Rockefeller's passing. So when we come to that, there's another element to this that's very important. But suffice to say that this is the passing of a titan of the wrong sort. And I don't know whether the world should breathe a sigh of relief or just look on to the next would-be one world consolidator who are following in the footsteps of people like Rockefeller. It's difficult to know what emotion to feel, but this was very important to recognize for the right reasons and to point out what David Rockefeller was really about. His family, him and Nelson, of course, one of his four brothers, five counting David, were instrumental in building the World Trade Center in the late 60s, early 70s, and tearing apart an entire neighborhood to do it, and having it become another large taxpayer boondoggle where the taxpayers paid the majority of the costs, and the plutocrats like Mr. Rockefeller and his brother Nelson avoided many of the regulatory and tax costs and passed those liabilities onto the taxpayer while they raked in the profits, which is the typical Rockefeller modus operandi. So they were involved heavily in building the World Trade Center. We hear so much about the destruction of it. They were involved in building it very intimately. In fact, they used to call the two towers Nelson and David. Sarcastically, New Yorkers would call those towers by those names. So enough said, but this is a very significant thing to acknowledge and chronicle today.
Okay, well, just in one word, if possible, do we actually know, is there an obvious successor?
There's not an obvious one. I'll look that up. It's interesting to note that the Rockefeller family operated out of three floors at Rockefeller Center at 30 Rock. It's the same building where they produced Saturday Night Live. And they call those three floors 5600. When you go there, the elevator that the normal public uses cannot access those floors. But that was command and control and remains the Rockefeller Command and Control Center for all the primary business and philanthropic interests of the family. So that's the nerve center. Perhaps some inquiries can be made as to who the main person running things will be in the days and weeks ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for that, Mark. Okay. Let's move on to snooping, and we'll get on to the GCHQ thing in a second. But let's begin with this. Now, this is a story from a week or so ago, which I missed, but I thought it was interesting, so we'll bring it up anyway. This is the National Grid, which is going to be Googled, it seems. So this is an artificial intelligence organization called DeepMind, part of Alphabet, which owns Google, and the National Grid have said that they are in early stage talks. This was originally broken, I think, by the Financial Times. They're aiming to reduce the UK's power usage through using neural networks and machine learning. They're hoping to reduce power usage in the UK by as much as 10% through what they're describing as AI-led optimization. So obviously the National Grid is responsible for the transportation of energy, electricity from the generators, private companies, to us, the consumer. So they run the power lines and the substations and all this sort of thing. So what Google is claiming they're going to be able to do is to plug into this already existing infrastructure without adding any additional infrastructure, and to assess the difference between supply and demand, and therefore help make decisions about what kind of demand is required. Now, the reason that they say this is required is, for example, that we have an alleged 13 gigawatts of wind power capacity in the country. But of course, that's all dependent on whether the wind is actually blowing or not. For example, on a cold, still winter's day, when actually we need electricity for heating or for whatever, it's not available through wind power. So they need to find it from other sources. And what they are claiming is that Google's or that Alphabet's AI infrastructure will be able to help make these decisions about what's going to happen in the future. DeepMind told the Financial Times that there's huge potential for predictive machine learning technology to help energy systems reduce their environmental impact. One really interesting possibility is whether we could help the National Grid maximize the use of renewables through using machine learning to predict peaks in demand and supply. But the question that I have, Mark and Brian, is will this in fact give Google access to, for example, smart meter data? I think it's very likely. Nobody seems to be asking this question. What are the privacy implications of that? Because, of course, what they're doing is simply gathering data, using what they're describing as AI to assess that data and help make decisions. I think that's a pretty potentially concerning development.
Mike, I think one of the key things with this is that we're seeing it has to be Google that comes in to do this. So we've got our national grid that is a grid to look after electricity supply for the United Kingdom. And now we're saying we don't have the technology, we don't have the trained engineers in this field to produce algorithms to monitor our own energy. So where I see the danger is that we're saying, oh, well, poor little UK can't really handle our energy. We've got to bring in Google. Really? I think this is complete and utter nonsense, and I think it's very dangerous.
Yes, I agree, but it's an excuse.
It's an excuse to bring them in for this.
Bring them in, yeah. And allow a massive data mining exercise, as far as I can see. Mark, briefly, any thoughts?
This is speculation, but it strikes me as something that could have been done at Googleberg or through Eric Schmidt and Google's association with Bilderberg, something that might have been put in place in the deal-making part of the Bilderberg meetings. And Bilderberg is supposed to meet tentatively. We're thinking they're going to meet in Virginia this year, June 1 through 4. That's just that's incomplete right now. That's not confirmed. But this strikes me, again, speculation, but it strikes me as something that could have been laid in terms of laying the groundwork at Bilderberg. And it also looks like almost like a giant smart meter, like an overall smart meter for the overall electrical grid. It strikes me conceptually that way. Maybe that's a little fanciful, but it looks like a smart meter for the entire country.
Okay, well, let's stick with the issue of snooping. GCHQ been in the news over the last few days. Well, the Foreign Secretary has now appointed a new GCHQ director. So Boris Johnson has announced that Jeremy Fleming has been appointed to succeed Robert Hannigan as director of GCHQ with the agreement of the Prime Minister. Jeremy Fleming joined the government from the private sector, they say, in 1993. He's a career MI5 officer. He was seconded to the Home Office. He joined the board of MI5 in 2005. He was seconded to the Home Office in 2007 to be director of strategy for the Office for Counterterrorism, and he led the revision of the government's counterterrorism strategy, which is called CONTEST. He returned to MI5 and became Director of Intelligence Collection, overseeing the bringing in of digital capabilities. He was promoted to Assistant Director General in 2011. He then became Deputy Director General in April 2013 with responsibility for core operational work and played a lead role, they say, in shaping the organisation to disrupt the changing face of the threat from terrorist groups and hostile state actors. So that's good. He's succeeding Robert Hannigan. Well, I understand that almost the first thing he's going to do is to pop across to the United States to give them a hard time over the Judge Napolitano allegations. If we remember what he said was that three intelligence sources had informed Fox News, particularly him, that President Obama went outside the chain of command to spy on Donald Trump while he was president-elect. He didn't use the NSA, that's Obama. He didn't use the CIA. He didn't use the FBI. He didn't use the Department of Justice. He used GCHQ. Well, a number of news outlets today pointing out that Napolitano seems to have disappeared from Fox News. He seems to have been sacked potentially, or at least suspended.
Silenced.
He's certainly been silenced in the meantime. Fox News haven't made any direct comment on it so far. GCHQ, of course, said that Napolitano's claims were utterly ridiculous and should be ignored. Nonetheless, it looks like Jeremy Fleming is heading straight over to the US to ask some questions about that. Mark, there was some activity going on, an inquiry at Congress yesterday, is that right? What was going on about this?
Well, the very day that David Rockefeller was pronounced dead, March 20, yesterday, the Intelligence Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives had as two witnesses FBI Director James Comey and the head of the NSA, Admiral Mike Rogers. And they're going over all these different allegations, the alleged ties of Trump's administration and appointees and his sundry allies, alleged ties with Russia, the allegations that Russia undercut our democracy, either by hacking voting machines and or email hacks that were used to discredit Hillary Clinton and catapult Trump into the White House. And as you're getting into here, Mike, the claim that by Trump that Obama, in a crude fashion, Trump saying that Obama wiretapped Trump Tower, and that was part of the reason that there were these illicit or illegal leaks of the activities of Admiral Michael Flynn in contacting Russia. How was that known? Well, there was spying on Trump's activities as the inauguration came up through Trump Tower and other means. And supposedly that outed the fact that Flynn had spoken to some Russian officials to try and calm the waters after Obama kicked those 35 Russian diplomats out of the country. Flynn reportedly was trying to keep things kosher with the Russians, but nevertheless, it's all predicated on this claim by Trump, however sophomoric his claim may sound, that he was surveilled or wiretapped by Obama. But Trump has a tendency, as you guys know, to shoot from the hip, to not really be as specific or as precise as he should. He's kind of got Tourette's syndrome on Twitter, and he may very well be aware that he was being surveilled, but not necessarily by whom. What you guys are bringing out today, I had heard about Napolitano being suspended, but I hadn't heard about this GCHQ thing. What you guys are bringing out today could very well be the smoking gun, or at least the well-lit corridor leading to the answers on this. Wouldn't it be interesting if this whole House Intelligence Committee thing was either a misfire or misdirected or a dog and pony show? To talk about only the NSA, only the FBI, only the CIA, when in fact it might have been none of them, and it might have been GCHQ. So this is a fresh line of inquiry, and even though this is a little speculative, that would certainly explain why Napolitano was silenced.
Yeah. Mark, I'll just remind you, you may have forgotten, but there was quite a lot of publicity here in UK. Whatever it was, I've lost track of time now, but I'm going to say at least 9 months ago, where it was revealed that NSA had actually been paying GCHQ large amounts of money, hundreds of millions of pounds, in order to specifically spy on phone lines. Now, nobody was saying where those phone lines were, but it was very interesting that money was changing hands. And also the money coming from NSA in America was also designed to basically grease the palms of GCHQ senior staff to encourage them to facilitate whatever demands the Americans were making. So I think putting together some of the publicity that's come out both sides of the Atlantic will get closer to what's been going on here. But I just want to bring this in and say, we covered this yesterday. This is somebody had put in a freedom of information request to Avon and Somerset Constabulary about child abuse involving witchcraft. Now, we're going to be talking about the engine of British politics, which is child abuse, a bit later in the news. But the interesting thing in this is, as we pointed out, that the police refused to give information, quoting Section 23.5, which says it was information supplied by or concerning certain security bodies. And then here it says the Freedom of Information Act 2000 stipulates a generic bar on disclosure of any information applied by or concerning certain security bodies. So our point here was that when you went asking questions about child abuse, the police hid behind Britain's security bodies. Well, of course, they wouldn't do anything dirty, would they? So I thought we'd also remind viewers of reports that have come up in the press. Here was the Mirror, British spies recruited pedo IRA chief, and a couple of articles in the Mirror on this particular subject. But time and again, we follow through to see Britain's so-called security services are being used to do dirty work around child abuse. Do I think they would help intercept internal American phone calls? Absolutely.
We cannot forget Kinkora, of course.
Kinkora Boys Home as well.
Let's move on to Syria. Now, the EU has issued more sanctions, this time against four high-ranking military officials, they say, in Syria. They're saying on the 20th of March 2017, the European Council added four high-ranking military officials to the list of those targeted by EU restrictive measures against the Syrian regime. The EU added these four persons for their role in the use of chemical weapons against the civilian population in line with the EU's policy to fight the proliferation and use of chemical weapons. So there you go. Here's what Tobias Elwood had to say, who's the Minister for the Middle East. New EU sanctions against those involved with chemical weapons use in Syria represent a significant step in holding those who have used chemical weapons to account. And I just want to know, when is this war criminal going to be held to account, Tony Blair? Because we may say that depleted uranium doesn't fall within the exact definition of a chemical weapon, but we spread that disgusting material right across the country and have left people to deal with it ever since.
Absolutely. But just come back on the man in black. Where is this evidence? So the EU's taken action, but where is the evidence? Because as we proved many, many months ago, after Brooks Newmark made this claim, if you checked the documents that came out of Porton Down or the UN, they talked about possibilities. There was no factual evidence that Assad's regime had used chemical weapons.
Absolutely. They're making it up as they go along. Let's have a look at this article on 21st Century Wire. Putin sends a message to Israel. Your freedom to act in Syria is over. So they're saying that as 21 Wire previously reported, Israel has attacked Syria again for the 12th time since the conflict in Syria began in 2011. Only this time Syria fired back. For the first time ever, Israel was forced to officially acknowledge the airstrike in Syria, most likely because this time an Israeli plane was downed, as well as another possibly hit while carrying out pre-dawn raids against Syria near Palmyra. Predictably, Israel are completely denying that planes were hit for PR reasons. However, Russia was not happy, and they basically told that Israel that the next time that Syrians use their... Israel told Syria that the next time that the Syrians use their air defence systems against Israeli planes, that they will destroy them without the slightest hesitation. The Russians told them to wise up. This would not be a terribly sensible thing to do. And at the end of the day, Israel bombing Syria on the basis of what?
Well, the claim was that Israel was bombing Hezbollah.
Yeah.
So they were protecting their own interests. But of course, this is military forces going into a sovereign state willy-nilly is an invasion. So when Syria was saying that, that effectively this was an attack on Syria. I think they're absolutely right.
Mark, Israel's starting to get a bit squeamish about people boycotting Israeli interests as a result of activities in Palestine and Syria.
Yes, indeed. You're showing the Atlanta Jewish Times out of Atlanta, Georgia, and one of several regional Jewish publications in the United States, some of them overtly, some of them covertly. While there's all the flap over Donald Trump wanting for about 90 days to ban people from only a limited number of Muslim nations so the U.S. security apparatus can get a handle on the flow and the nature of the people coming into the U.S. from those countries, while there's all that flap over that, people erroneously or mistakenly or brazenly calling it a ban when it actually is just a temporary relief in the flow of people. Israel, according to even Jewish publications, not only We Are Change, where I first read this, Israel is evidently banning people coming into Israel who have publicly or openly supported boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And that, of course, is the movement BDS that is championed primarily by people that are pro-Palestinian, that believe the Israeli state is brutal in its apartheid policies toward and its brutal airstrikes against the Gazans and the Gaza Strip and Palestinians in the West Bank. And so once again, Israel is being completely hypocritical and is being the most isolated, the most isolationist, the most garrison state of all. They don't let any Syrian or other refugees into their country, yet Europe and the United States are supposed to allow unlimited amounts into their countries. And yet Israel turns around now, and we're hearing from a reliable source, this Jewish publication out of the U.S., that they're disallowing public pro-BDS people to enter Israel. So why don't we hear about this travel ban? All we hear is the flap over Trump's so-called travel ban. This is a very interesting development, though not unexpected necessarily. And what you guys just brought up is typical of the doublespeak of the Israeli state attacking Syria undercover, not doing it in a well-known or public or open way. And that of course, would also explain this ongoing antagonism toward Russia. Israel is evidently using the United States and all the controversy over Trump colluding with Russia in order to keep Russia kind of isolated in terms of public opinion, and therefore give the Israeli forces more free rein in Syria, in my opinion, to kind of keep Russia at bay. Otherwise, Russia very well might push back a lot harder against these clandestine attacks that the Israelis are carrying out in Syria. So this is all, a lot of dots are connecting right here as all these issues come to the fore.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on to Brexit then, because, of course, Theresa May has announced that Brexit is going to be formalized next Wednesday, the 29th of March, Article 50 invoked. Immediately that happens, or at least within a month or so of that, or I think exactly a month actually looking at this, there's going to be a summit of EU member states to discuss Brexit. That's going to be held on the 29th of April, a month after Theresa triggers Article 50. That meeting is going to be used to agree guidelines for the EU's negotiating team. Britain is not going to be involved in that meeting. Donald Tusk said that the priority is going to be for giving clarity to EU residents. Theresa May said that she's hoping that formal talks will get underway as quickly as possible after that. Another article that I missed from a couple of weeks ago that I wanted to highlight was this from TruePublica saying, Liam Fox doesn't want you to know about the EU-Canada trade deal. This is from Amy Hall, who is from Open Democracy UK. And she's saying, meet the corporate sell-off trade deal that Dr. Liam Fox snuck through a back room of Parliament as the Commons debated Brexit. So she's talking about this this meeting taking place at the same time as the final Brexit vote, which took place a couple of weeks ago. And she says she's talking about CETA, the EU-Canadian trade deal. And she says if the European Parliament votes CETA through, well, in fact, they did do that on the 15th of February, much of the deal can be provisionally implemented without the agreement of member states. And she rightly points out that while Britain remains part of the EU, we will be bound by this because despite the fact that Article 50 will be invoked on Wednesday, that doesn't mean anything. We still remain full members of the EU until the day we actually leave. And so we're bound and we've agreed to be bound by all the commitments that we had previously. And then she goes on to say, if our Parliament, the British Parliament, ratifies CETA before we leave the EU, we will be bound by the whole thing. And that, of course, is the point that we have been really trying to make with regard to this whole issue of Brexit and whether we're actually leaving the EU or not. Now, this was the interesting quote from this article. Brexit or not, Britain faces CETA or something that resembles it uncannily. This is our point. It doesn't matter whether you look at defence, whether you look at border controls, whether you look at agriculture, whether you look at fishing. We've got to remember that the full body of EU law will be merged into British domestic law on the day we supposedly leave the European Union. And if it looks like something, if it smells like something, if it speaks like something, whether we, as a PR exercise, are saying in or out makes no difference. If it resembles it uncannily, Brian, we're in.
We're in. And we're not coming out.
And we're not coming out. However, Philip Hammond was discussing the so-called leaving fee of £50 billion, the divorce bill, as the Telegraph is putting it here. Philip Hammond does not recognise EU demands for £50 billion. Well, the Telegraph report saying that Hammond has been told by ministers that they are categorically against paying a big lump sum. The amount that the British government is talking about is something like £2 to £3 billion. But Philip Hammond doesn't recognise the EU demands for £50 billion. What does not recognise means? It's one of these phrases which is starting to be used more and more commonly recently. What that means is that he actually accepts that that's the amount that he's going to have to pay. But he doesn't want to deny that he's going to pay that because he knows that he is going to pay it. So he would be lying if he was deny it. So he says that he doesn't recognise it because that's not quite as strong as saying that he isn't going to pay it. So that's one of those sort of newspeaky type phrases that they're using these days. But we could look at this another way. I mean, some people may view £50 billion as not being a huge amount if it means actually getting out of the European Union. That's a different debate. But the point that I would make here is, of course, we're handing £50 billion every year over to an interest payments on government debt. Perhaps we should keep that in perspective. But just to finish this section, I wanted to highlight the Daily Express for being the fake news outlet once again. March the 29th, 2019, the date set for our EU exit. This is a lie. This is fake news. Sorry, guys. The whole two-year thing is purely speculative, and any suggestion that it is the date set is complete and utter nonsense.
Yeah. I'm going to pause there, Mike, because I got to the point I don't know what to say to this. We continue to say, of course, everything to do with leaving the EU is an utter scam, and the military integration unification goes on apace.
Absolutely. Now, Mark, many people won't be aware that the European Union actually has an ambassador in the United States. And what is this? The delegation of the European Union to the United States. What's going on at this event?
This is a follow-up on the EU's activities that started 3 or 4 years ago to get state governments in the U.S. on board with transatlantic relations and the TTIP treaty. And this is one of the cultural technology innovation ways they're doing it. The European Union delegation of the United States for the first time took up a presence. They set up some booths and some displays at the well-known annual South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas, which is the state capital of Texas. And they called their setup for the EU, they called their venue, quote, the go-to place for a European perspective on cutting-edge technologies, creative thinking, and innovation. Nothing totally wrong with all that necessarily. And yes, the EU ambassador to the US, David O'Sullivan, spoke there. This was the highlight on March 11. I tried to make it to the event. I was unable to, unfortunately, at the last minute, but I got some firsthand information here. His topic was the EU's digital single market breaking down barriers. Once again, breaking down barriers. That's always the raison d'etre of this whole outfit, breaking down cultural barriers, breaking down economic barriers by getting rid of tariffs, having completely unregulated immigration. Any kind of even gender barriers are broken down in this worldview of those that run the EU. But at any rate, to give you some taste of what he spoke about that day, Mr. O'Sullivan, it is, according to the South by Southwest website that had input from the EU delegation, it spoke of, in May 2015, the European Commission announced the Digital Single Market Strategy, an ambitious agenda to take the EU's single market of 508 million people from the physical to the digital space. And the Digital Single Market Strategy will, quote, create more opportunities for all, not just Europeans, to invest, trade, and conduct business in the European digital space. And they ask questions like, what are the DSMs, this single market's implications for the transatlantic digital economy? How can companies around the world prepare themselves to engage successfully in a new single European digital marketplace? Note the word here, single marketplace. Again, consolidation, centralization, always knocking down barriers. Whether those barriers are helpful or not is immaterial to these people. So this panel brought together the policymakers and people from companies on both sides of the Atlantic, talking about breaking down these digital barriers and creating what they call opportunities within the European Union and its 28 member states, but also between the European Union and the United States, which fits the TTIP mold, of course, the basic framework of it. So this is just another area kind of on the cultural and technology plane where the EU delegation to the US, which is a lobby set up in Washington, D.C., by the way, it's not in Europe. It's mainly in D.C. This is another way in their now 4 or 5 year old strategy to get individual states in the U.S. on board with transatlantic consolidation and the TTIP treaty. That's what this is really all about. And it's just another building block toward that end.
Yeah. OK, thanks, Mark. OK, we'll move on to justice because the prisons and courts bill is being debated in the House of Commons this week. Now, the process that got us to this point, I suppose, began with this report from Lord Justice Leveson, the Right Honourable Sir Brian Leveson, who is the President of the Queen's Bench back in January 2015. And he had been talking about the future sort of shape of justice and what it might look like. And he was particularly talking about the digitisation of justice and the use of IT and video links and video and audio hearings. And he was saying that video and audio hearings in particular should be the default position for justice in this country. Now, the Prisons and Courts Bill is going to transform the lives of offenders and put victims at the heart of the justice system, is what the government is saying. And they're helping to create a safer and better society. The bill's covering prison safety and reform, it's covering court reform, it's covering the judiciary, and it's covering whiplash compensation. And the whiplash compensation thing is just there, I think, just to get the headlines and try to cover over the rest of the stuff, because it's particularly the court reform the thing we need to look at. So what they're saying is that measures relating to courts underline a commitment, they say, to victims and the most vulnerable. They're saying that the use of virtual hearings, just as Leveson was keen to promote, the use of virtual hearings will be extended, allowing victims to take part without running the risk of coming face-to-face with their assailant. Many hearings, such as bail hearings, will be resolved via video or telephone conferencing. And one of the points that we made, Brian, was that, of course, when we were talking about this last time, was, of course, it isn't possible under these circumstances to see justice being done. We'll come on to that again in a second. Now, Liz Truss, the Secretary of State for Justice, said our courts should be places where victims get the justice they deserve and where outstanding independent judiciary can flourish and focus on the cases that matter. And if we look at the media over the last couple of weeks, we've seen a lot of articles and coverage in the media about how difficult it is for particularly victims of rape to appear in courts. It's a really stressful thing for them because they're being cross-examined by the solicitors working for the alleged perpetrator. It's a really harrowing time, and therefore it would be much better if it all happened via video link and so on. Well, we were concerned, as you as I said, that justice would not seem to be done, because of course if it's happening by video link, then the public can't witness what's going on. Well, what the government has now said is that to ensure justice is also open and seen to be done, video booths will be installed in courts across England and Wales to allow members of the media and the public to observe virtual hearings from court buildings anywhere in the country. And Brian, I think we agree that this is utterly dangerous, because you go into a video booth, you see a video being played, it's like watching a television screen. You don't know whether that's happening live or not. It may say live in the corner of the screen, but do you know whether it's live? Has it been edited?
Yeah.
This has got to be the biggest attack on justice that we've ever seen.
And if there's a failure in that link, or there's a malicious attack on the link and the link's cut off, that's the court proceeding interfered with. And that's exactly the trick that was used with Melanie Shaw. And I can name other court cases where people have had to speak on video links from a prison where there was unbelievable noise going on in the background as they were trying to give their testimony. So this is outrageous. This is to deny proper common law and proper trial by jury.
Absolutely. Well, Justice Minister Sir Oliver Heald said Britain has the best justice system in the world. I don't think so.
No, well, I think we're going to show that's the case. Now, I'll just say, Mark, for the next section, I'll move through it quite quickly, but I'm going to use you, if I may, as the American guinea pig. So we'll go through and then we'll have a little bit of time to chat before we close on the news today. But for those people concerned about justice, British Constitution Group, 22nd of April in the Albert Hall, Nottingham. This is a vast space, and what the British Constitution Group is doing is bringing people together to discuss the situation, but more importantly, to say what people are doing to stop what is happening. So share your expertise, build friends, build networks. No more hope. We are not hoping. It is time to act. It's time to do things. So if you're not already signed up for that, if you haven't already got your ticket, please get onto the British Constitution Group website and buy one. Well, let's have a look at justice in UK and the favourite subject, which is the powerhouse of British politics, which is the abuse of children. Now, a couple of weeks ago, we came up with this headline. It was Police Chief Heath was a paedophile. And we'd labelled this astonishing claims, get ready for the males attack. This was the journalist that produced the article, Simon Walters. He's previously been given Journalist of the Year. What did they have to say? Well, this was inside the Mail on Sunday. Is he guilty? Yes, I'm 120% sure. That's the stunning verdict of Wiltshire Chief Constable, Mr. Veal. Now, we took the Mail to task over this because if you read the article, he absolutely didn't say it. A source said Mr. Veal believes in them, the allegations 120%. Mr. Veal himself did not say it, and the article provided no evidence. And right at the end of the article, this is reinforced. Further asked if Mr. Veal had 120% faith in the allegations, the police spokesman declined to comment. So this was a false article, and we said there's a reason that they've done this. It's because they are going to attack. And we pointed out this down in the corner because here was the smear. It started to talk about Heath's accuser being, quote, a satanic sex fantasist. So there's the key word, fantasist. Well, we were absolutely right because yesterday we were alerted to this story also from the Daily Mail. 1 million Heath sex abuse inquiry to be closed. This was written by the Daily Mail crime reporter Rebecca Camber, and she said that the investigation was going to be closed. A source for the UK column spoke directly to Wiltshire Police. They said this is absolutely untrue. So we have, first of all, something that the police are saying is untrue. But then we notice this, because who does this lady use to smear the police? Yesterday, Lord Armstrong, the former cabinet secretary and Sir Edward's principal private secretary from 1970 to 74 said, "I simply don't understand how the chief constable got himself into such a position." So the Daily Mail helping the former private secretary of Mr. Heath to gently undermine the police investigation. Well, who was the journalist? A remarkable lady, because when you go looking for her, she's simply anonymous, Mike. We couldn't find any real detail. I put out some feelers to other mainstream journalists that we can talk to and said, "Do you know about this?" But they didn't really.
Well, hold on. If we just go back to that one second. For a journalist for a mainstream newspaper, she's not following anybody on Twitter. She hasn't got any followers on Twitter. Is this actually a real person?
Well, this is one of the questions. Now, all I can say is that when I did ask a couple of mainstream journalists and I mentioned the name, they knew who I was talking about. But is this an alias? Is this a real person? We've no idea. Well, why are we interested in this lady and her use of Mr. Armstrong? Well, let's jump back to the Mail in Scotland that a couple of years ago reported this story. Mandarin, who can't help being economical with the truth, Lord Armstrong at the centre of accusations of child abuse cover-up. And basically, what this story is about is this gentleman working with MI6, bringing the security services again, and what were they doing? They were pushing the child abuse under the carpet in order to protect the state. So this is some of the comment from that article. Lord Armstrong, who was Margaret Thatcher's cabinet secretary for 8 years, is now at the centre of accusations of a major establishment cover-up of child abuse by leading public figures in the 70s and 80s. It has been revealed he was urged... Sorry, I said MI6, I meant MI5. It's been revealed that he was urged by MI5 to help hush up abuse allegations against a senior MP so as to avoid, quote, political embarrassment for the Thatcher government. And even today, despite years of official investigations into the claims and a top-level review into the loss of hundreds of Home Office files relating to the original allegations, Armstrong defiantly refuses to identify the suspect politician or even say if he's alive or dead. So I'm going to put a label on that and say, why does the Daily Mail want to use this man to help undermine a police child abuse investigation? Any clues, Mike?
Well, and indeed, they seem to be undermining their own reporters.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Different position taken between the Daily Mail and the Mail in Scotland.
Yeah, just quite remarkable. So let's bring in this letter, which Robert Green has sent to Paul Dacre, the editor of the Daily Mail. And basically, he's questioning over the reporting here. I'll come to the important points. He says, secondly, and possibly even more seriously, Wiltshire Police has confirmed that the Daily Mail has indulged in fake news. The investigation into Edward Heath has not been called off. And then in the paragraph below, Robert points out, of course, that there's no real comment by the Mail on Tim Fortescue, the chief whip to Edward Heath, who admits to BBC camera that they covered up for MPs abusing children.
But the Mail has mentioned that in past articles, if we go back 4 or 5 years.
This is the interesting thing, because they have mentioned it in the past, but of course it's relevant now that we have Wiltshire Police investigating Heath. And I'll go to the final part, because here it says, finally, I have provided expert witness evidence regarding Edward Heath and others that has been accepted by Wiltshire Police. Included in those names are two of your most senior journalists. The reputation of your newspaper could hardly be more at risk over this issue. I trust that the readers will be treated to a more balanced and truthful journalism over the issue in future. So very quickly, Mark, that's a little snapshot into the cesspit, which is British government. But without any doubt, over the years, the evidence has been paraded in front of the public that we have British politicians who are abusing children and secret services who are helping that abuse to be covered up in order to blackmail individuals to do their bidding. Boys Town in America seems to me to be a mirror image of this.
Indeed it was. And then the Nebraska senator, the state senator, John DeCamp, brought out a very important book some 20 years ago, if memory serves, as to when it came out, talking about a huge network out of Omaha, Nebraska, which is now the nerve center of Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett's financial empire. Not necessarily a connection there, I don't mean that. But this was the big thing where kids were kidnapped and networked over to Washington, D.C. Only the Washington Times broke one important story about the network, which involved a credit union manager named Larry King, not the talk show host, a different guy. He was even a black guy. But that was the big network here. Boys Town was sort of in that orbit, as I recall. But yes, that's been the age-old technique of controlling political elites. Either they're somehow cajoled or coerced or flim-flammed into engaging in pedophilia, or they know enough about it. And either way, they can't speak about their own indulgences or the indulgences of others. And that's what primarily keeps the silence. But indeed, so as in Britain, as in America, this is the primary way they control politicians from speaking out about those and many other forms of injustices.
Yeah, thank you for that. And of course, there's going to be a lot more information about this subject coming out in UK and also stateside over the coming weeks. We feel that there's been some encouraging developments in the truth coming up to the surface. And as we've been able to report here in UK, we know that many, many British police men and women are now speaking out because they are simply fed up with senior police officers attempting to protect these high-level political individuals. That brings us really to the close of the news. Mark, thank you very much for joining us. Always good to have your contribution. You're now free to have your cup of coffee and breakfast. And we'll say to our viewers, thank you very much for joining us. If you're not already a subscriber, please subscribe because we need your donations to keep us reporting the news as we do. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.